Gill, and I'm excited to come back to E-Town on November 17th, and I'm promoting my new record, Nostalgia Kill, and I'm here with Rabbi Saul Solomon, and Dave's gone by, and Oy Vey, a Jew from Denver, that's me.
Oh, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am so thrilled. You know, it is rare for someone to be on the Dave's Gone By Facebookio radio program of the stream more than once, like two times. Ooh, that's a big honor. That's a glorious thing. But this person that I am about to talk to now, she, counting today, will have been on Dave's Gone By for three times over the years. The only sad part is it's been more than a decade since we last talked to her. But guess what? Jill Sabule is still out there. She is performing, she is touring, and she has a wonderful new CD called Nostalgia Kills. You know, the New York Times music critic John Pareles once said that Jill Sabule could claim her place among the stellar New York singer-songwriters of the last decade. Now, granted, he wrote that in the year 2000, so in this current decade, who the hell knows? But I think, judging by her CD, she's still great, and she's still here, and she's Jill Sabule. Shalom, Jill!
Shalom, Rabbi. I'm so happy to be talking to you. It's been too long.
It has been. It's been a decade since you've been on the program. How you been overall? Was it a good decade?
You know what? I'm healthy. I'm semi-happy. I've got a new record out, and I've learned a lot. It doesn't seem that long. That's the craziness about it. As you get older, time goes by so fast. So it doesn't seem that long since I last talked to you.
And people might not realize that Jill is a Jewess. And if you didn't know that when she said she's semi-happy, that's about as good as a Jew gets, by the way. No, you're not going to find a happy Jew, but semi-happy. So what's making you happy currently? Well, the music, of course. And what's making you not so happy currently?
Well, I think what's not making me as happy can I be Jewish for a moment?
Oh, absolutely.
Right now, my back is hurting.
Oy.
Terrible. Not bad. That's just a little bit of it. I think also, I think like a lot of people, I've been consumed with the politics of the day and what's coming up. And I think it's concerning. And I'm Jewish. What am I going to say? I've been seeing someone who's Italian, and she says that they call Italians happy Jews. Italians are happy Jews.
Yeah, and they're just as loud and just as obnoxious in restaurants. And yet still, they're quite... So how did you meet this nice Italian girl?
In Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Yes, actually, I was there in Pittsburgh a couple days before the shooting and saw the beautiful community there in Swirlera. But I kind of like Pittsburgh. Outside of that little area, it's not very Jewish, I have to tell you.
Well, it's even less Jewish now, if you think about it, but...
But it's like the person I was seeing beforehand, the same from Alabama, and they actually thought that, never grew up with Jews, but that Jew was a verb. The Jew was a verb growing up.
Oh, I've heard that, but...
And I used to get, and I would get, when I lived in the South for a couple of years, I would always get, you don't seem Jew, you don't seem like a Jew.
Well, they mean that, I hate to say, as a compliment. They mean that, you got these cute Danish-looking features, you know, the big eye, you're a cute girl. Which people say, oh, Jews don't look like that, they're not blonde, they're not like that. I don't know, they mean well, except they're horrible, and you want to stab them when they say
that. Yeah, they mean well, but they're horrible. And I did, for a moment, you talk about my eyes and everything, but there was a moment I thought, maybe my mother had an affair with my stepfather earlier on. Maybe I've got some other kind of blood in me, but no.
Well, wait a minute, actually, the irony, but your mom did actually have an affair, so how can you be so sure that you weren't...
Because I did the 23andMe. It's like 99% Ashkenazi and 1% Neanderthal.
Oh!
There's not an Irish blood in there.
I'm like 40% Neanderthal, just mentally, basically. That's not even bothering to send in the kit.
Neanderthals are a lot smarter than we thought they were.
Really?
Yeah, they get it bad. They're good, yeah.
Well, they had so much forehead, there must have been some brain behind it, I guess. I don't know. But anywho, but you didn't get to say, like, how did you meet your girlfriend?
Do you really want to hear?
Well, if it's an interesting story, you were in Pittsburgh. I mean, was she at your concert? Was something else? What?
Well, I was been spending time in Pittsburgh for working on. I'm working on a theater piece called #, and they told me I could use language.
Yes.
#fuck seventh grade. #fuck seventh grade. That is a theater piece I'm working on. So I was in Pittsburgh and working with this at the theater company, and I had put on a house concert, and I met this woman. I met her a couple times before, and I was we're workshopping the theater piece, and it's really about how horrible seventh grade is. But there's one song about the first kiss you ever have. Like, do you remember it's always awkward. Sometimes it's done with spin the bottle. But do you remember the first kiss you had, Rabbi?
Yes, unfortunately, Jewish people in Israel kiss each other on the mouth. Even the rabbis do. So it was a lot of beard and a lot of fish breath. You don't want to know from it.
Wow, that's a good, that's a new one.
Yeah. But your first kiss, was it that Wendell Lee guy or no?
No, well, the first kiss was in, sixth grade, and it was a spin the bottle, and it was, not a lot of tongue. It was just a dumb kind of kiss. I remember it was Robbie Naaman.
Oh, okay.
Nice Jewish boy, who, by the way, Robbie Naaman asked me to go steady that year, and after 1 week, he dropped me.
Ooh, I'll bet he's regretting that.
He's been trying to be my Facebook friend forever.
Now, wait. So you're blocking him or you're not letting him be your Facebook friend because you still hold a grudge 50 years later?
Well, actually, he wrote a really sweet little note that said it was cute. Like, I hadn't seen him since 8th or 9th grade, and he goes, I hope you're still not mad at me. And I did my best kind of Tallulah Bankhead, and I wrote him back saying, I always knew you'd come crawling back one day. But I've talked to him.
Oh, all right. Because this grudge is... I'm friends on Facebook with people who used to bully me and pull up my underwear and things.
And you're friends with them?
Yeah. And they did it just last week. I still have the burns. But no, I'm kidding. I don't know what that means. So this woman you saw at the house concert, she did...
Okay.
What?
So the story is I was writing a song about the first awkward kiss. And, just the little thing you have, and so we were flirting and texting each other. I can't believe I'm saying this. And I'm the least flirty or forward person ever. I'm just so shy about that stuff. But I wrote her and said, I'm writing a song about the very first kiss, how awkward and weird it is. Why don't we reenact it for, 5 minutes? Just the pre-kiss, not, the where... And that's how it started.
Oh, well, Mazel, because it is... How does it feel, though? You're getting into this new relationship, and yet you have to promote and sing songs from an album that are partially based on a breakup of an older relationship. Is there a disconnect there?
No, because, when you sing the... When I sing, I just go back in time. I go back and sing it, and the thing about it is, and maybe there's a Jewish thing there, too, is that I'm so much better at singing, writing really sad or depressing or angry or breakup songs. They're just so much more easier. When you're trying to write a song about the happy stuff, it's really a harder thing to do because you got to be aware if you're going to be cheesy or not. And so
you skirted that with a song on one of your earlier albums where you say, I don't want to be bitter. I don't want to be jaded. So that's kind of a straggling both lines. You can do that.
I can do that, too. So who knows what my next songs will be? It's very early on. I still have plenty of time to get miserable with it.
You are Jewish. This is true. But we're reminding people that we're talking with the wonderful Jill Sabule, talking about her new album, Nostalgia Kills. You've got a song on there that's already a single there called I Don't Want to Wake Up. And what's interesting to me about that is, and there's a couple of songs on this album and previous albums, it's funny, like, we talked 12 years ago. And I remember you saying that you love dreams and you have these romantic, not romantic, but adventure fantasy dreams, like wearing a pith helmet and being on a dig and falling in love with someone and having these scary Indiana Jones type things. And it's still there, this idea of wanting to escape into dreams.
I think I'm one of those that I make an active effort to remember my dreams, to write them down when I get up. I find that if you don't, that you're missing such a big part of your life. And I have to admit that I Don't Want to Wake was a little bit mixed in with some mushrooms. There was a little bit of psychedelic involved in that one, too.
Oh.
But it was a dream state, and I felt like I hadn't done that since I was in 10th grade.
Why did you, our age, I should say, you're less worried about killing brain cells and going on a trip that you can never come back from?
Yeah, what's the worst that can happen? Well, I'm not a person that, like, I don't like weed. It makes me paranoid, and I've really never been a drinker. So, and I was going through something people you keep hearing about and rep, you know. Try a little microdosing or try a little mushroom. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. At the same time, when I was writing that song, I was reading a lot about the history, like history of God, historical Jesus, just a lot of nonfiction on religion. And I think on that, if you listen to it, it straddles between a good trip and a bad trip.
As does life. As does Judaism, for gosh sakes. I know, right?
I know.
My problem is I tried writing some Hasidic song while doing mushrooms. Didn't work. I tried red
pepper. How did it go?
No, I tried red pepper. That didn't work either. Spinach, kale, nothing. Hummus I tried. Didn't do a damn thing for me. I don't know what you see in mushrooms. Were they marinated?
They were awful tasting.
And
I'm also a person, I just took such a teeny little bit. But, yeah, but it just brought up. It was an interesting experiment.
Well, here's a song. And speaking
next time I see you, I'll come and we'll make a little mushroom souffle for you.
Oh, I would try that. That would be good. It has to be kosher, though. You know that.
But they are so kosher.
And no meat and milk in there. You know, you can have cream, but then I have to wait an hour before I swim. It all gets very complicated. I don't know what I'm talking about anyway. But other songs on the album, since it all has to deal with a lot of it, with nostalgia and thinking back, the good and the bad, you have a wonderful song called The Island of Lost Toys. And I want to ask you, was there a...
What's actually Island of Lost Things?
Oh, I'm sorry, Lost Things. Excuse me. I confused it with Island of Misfit Toys, which is basically where I belong. Yeah. But it's Island of Lost Things. So was there something that you had growing up that either you still keep or have, or something that you always wish you could find that you may have tossed out, like a Toy Story thing?
Well, yeah, in fact, I loved when I was a little girl. I loved anything to do with spies, and I loved James Bond and the Avengers and Man from U.N.C.L.E. I'm Dating Myself, anything spy-like. And I remember having the Corgi, a car. I had the 007 Aston Martin car, which I loved. It had the ejector seat, a little guy that would, you know, everyone lost that would come out. And like all my things, my mother threw them away or gave them away, and I thought about that forever. And last year, someone who actually works at the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I talked about it, and I got it in the mail.
Oh! See, it's good to be sort of famous, isn't it? You know, you get to mention things. It's kind of like when the Beatles were at the peak of their Beagledom, and Paul got on the thing and said, you know, I mentioned at one point that we really love jelly babies. And then everybody started sending us, please stop sending us jelly babies. He should have said, hey, please start sending us money. That would have worked.
Now, what was something from your childhood?
Oh, I used to have an inflatable Etrog. I missed that. That was fun. I used it as a pillow on airplanes. It was wonderful. But now, speaking of sending money, this is kind of cool because the last two or three albums that you did, because you're not on quote-unquote the major big label anymore, you do your own label. You're on, what is it, Pinko Records?
I'm Pinko Records.
Are you yourself responsible for production, distribution, mailing? How big is this operation?
Well, I hired some people, but I have to tell you, it's really hard to do it yourself because it takes so much time and organization when you could be writing songs, which I'd rather be doing, but organization is not in my wheelhouse. So it's been, that's why it's been a while, but the artist has to do a lot themselves unless they're the 0.001% of the...
Another person who has been on this program is the great Jane Siberry. And she was one of the pioneers.
I love her so much.
Oh, yeah. I'm a genius. But she was one of these pioneers also in taking her entire career into her own hands. But at a certain point, it was like, you get up in the morning and suddenly you're addressing envelopes and sealing them and going to the post office. And, should an artist have to do that much beyond the creative part? That's the balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it takes a lot of time. And you get things, I'm not sending them out personally, but I have someone doing them, but I'm getting all the things like today. Someone got their record, but my signature, it was a sign, got smudged.
Oh.
So we have to sign it, send another one. And the thing is you want to be really, I rely on a fan base, so you want to be really good to everyone, so...
People who have been good to you, you mentioned, this is a kind of a cool thing that you do, is on the end of the CD, you have a little song where you mention a bunch of people who gave a certain amount of money towards the fund, whether it was Kickstarter or Indiegogo, to raise the money for the CD. And among them, how do you know Fred Savage, the Wonder Boys guy? What do you
use? He's a fan. He's a fan. Well, yeah, and I got fans who are, on my Kickstarter, the highest level I did, and it was a total joke. It was $10,000. You Will Be on My Record, My Personal Lord and Savior. And Joss Whedon of Buffy the Vampire fame is my personal Lord and Savior. I know that's not... there you go. He's my personal Lord and Savior on the record.
Whoa. So, now, did you know him? Did you ever have any of your songs on Buffy or any of the programs that he does?
Yeah, it was on Buffy, but we did... He's a fan. And the other person, who gets a theme song, one of the levels is I write you a theme song, which I haven't done yet, is Tom Bergeron, the guy who hosts Dancing with the Stars.
Well, you mentioned him in that track, but you just name check him. So he's already mentioned Tom Bergeron. Now, no one would. I mean, Fred Savage, I get, but who would think that Tom Bergeron, the dancing guy, is a big fan of yours? Not that he wouldn't be. Not that you wouldn't appeal to everybody, but it just sort of comes out of the blue.
It comes out of the blue. But knowing I've known him for a while, and he is a closeted. He's not so. I mean,
let's watch that word.
I mean, he is the coolest person. He's just got a cool, and it's not positive. He comes across, he's got a great demeanor and everything, but he's a really good guy. So I actually think most of the people that like my music are good. I'd hang out with them.
Yeah, I mean, one hopes you're not making music for Deep South Republicans, if you know what I'm saying.
Well,
maybe you are. Maybe you are. Hard to tell.
Like if I did, which I do like, but if my genre was 70s or southern rock, I might have a different audience base. Not saying I don't like it either, but
Yeah, or if you were doing country, going directly into real country music, which is not that big a stretch. You throw in a slide guitar and a dobro, there you are. But that's not what you do, so...
Right, I could be playing... Yeah, I could be opening for Toby Keith.
God forbid. But anyway, let's talk, since we're talking music, and we want to talk a little bit of theater. Since we talked to you in the neighborhood, you did have a show up. You did a, you know, you're working on a show now, but something called Prozac and the Platypus. How did that go?
Well, I haven't had one since then. Prozac and the Platypus I've had, but last year, NYU, the kids, did a musical of mine called Times Square. I don't know if you remember, there was a kind of a cult movie in 1980 called Times Square. Maybe it was 78.
No.
About two girls, one runaway in New York City. So we did an adaptation of that. And I really enjoy working in musical theater. And they have me do it because they want to do something different than traditional jazz hand musical theater, which I wouldn't even be able to know how to do. So I did music to the original production, Broadway production of Yentl. And that was, not the Barbara Streisand version.
Right. Now, wait. Who's doing that? Because I heard about you adapting Yentl.
There was a few theaters. There was St. Louis Theater, the Jewish Theater in Washington, D.C. We've done it about four places. And here's what's great is it's kind of klezmer folky punk. And when I did it in New York, we did one night of the music at Lincoln Center. And I worked with this band who were all female, klezmer, amazing artists. And the band is called Isle of Klezbos.
Oh,
great band name.
I love that. That name is fantastic. They've been around for like 20 years. I think Deborah Kreisberg is in there or somebody.
So you know them, of course.
Well, yes, I know. I once dated a girl who became a klezmer musician. Now she's a klezbian. But you know. Thank you ever so much. It's just riffing on the same joke, essentially. But yeah. It's interesting that you don't feel comfortable yet or you're dipping a toe in, but not ready to jump into Rodgers and Hart style, Rodgers and Hammerstein, William Finn, Sondheim, well, maybe Finn kind of stuff. You're still staying in the pop mode, but theater has different demands when you're talking about how to craft a song for the theater.
Well, theater's changing, and also I'm adapting too. So, and it's also what I mean. People seek you out because of what you do, and I'm a pop, but not. But I've always had told a story in my songs. I come from maybe the older of the singer songwriters that told stories. And so I think that it's not that incompatible.
Hmm. And are there things that you're learning now, having done not just one musical, but working on all these, you're working on Fuck the Seventh Grade, the solo show, you got Prozac and the Platypus, the Yentl thing. Are there things you know now that you didn't know 10 years ago?
No, I think you have to still expand and keep learning, and I think as you get older, sometimes your natural tendency is to go to the same place you've been before, musically and lyrically, and it is good to experiment and to be open and to figure out if you're writing for a character, what that character's sound is like, what that, I just think you're always learning.
Ooh, I like that.
You're in trouble.
Now, you started off, you were in a band many, many years ago, but essentially people think of you as a solo artist. And yet more and more, especially if you're doing theater and things like that, you're collaborating. You do a lot with Julia Sweeney. And then there's somebody named Robin Eaton who you apparently co-write a bit with. How do you do that in terms of knowing when you want to write a song by yourself and when you sit down with someone else and say, okay, I'm open, you're open, let's see what happens?
Well, I think in the case of Robin, because we've been doing it for over 20-something years, that we know each other so well. We know you know, it's that kind of relationship when I got a great idea and I'll be able to say that sucks. You know, and we can laugh at it. There's no,
okay, but
ego involved, and so that's easy to do.
And in terms of, I mean, sometimes it's easier when you have collaborators. One is the lyricist and one is the composer, but you generally do both. So do you sort of reserve the melody for yourself and then collaborate on the lyrics, or is it all sort of up for grabs?
It's always different. I mean, if it's a song for me, I kind of like have the final say on things. I'm bossy.
Oh.
But I have no ego.
That's kind of an ideal combination there. Almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I get it. It's like you want the best for the song, and you're not going to let anything as an artist stand in your way of getting that, but you're also not going to be an asshole about it.
What?
If only I could learn that. Yeah.
If only you could be that way?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just horrible every possible way, it's true. Now, also, I want to ask the wonderful Jill Sabule here about, I lost what I was going to. Oh, yes. You've been doing now, among the other things that you have to do when you are your own career, in a way, when you own your own career, is you do these house concerts where it can be anything from a few people who have a lot of money can hire you and you do a little thing, or somebody's got a big backyard and they make people pay $20 to get in and they have a wonderful night. So do you have any amazing, funny, or weird or scary stories in doing these concerts, not in halls, but essentially in people's living spaces?
You know, that's the other thing, is that I've done so many of them over the last couple of years and nothing comes to mind as weird or anything odd. I mean, there's some fabulous things when people have their houses on a cliff in Monterey Bay, and they're all so different. I mean, there was one that I loved. We did. It was in Virginia, outside of D.C. And a guy instead of his house, he rented a VFW hall. So, but it was still open for the customers. So it was this combination of people who see my music and Vietnam vets sitting at the bar eating, you know, hot nuts and everyone got on. There was something so great about it. It had shag carpet and
wow.
It was a great scene. It's always so different. That's the thing too.
And what a perfect place to do an album called Nostalgia Kills than a VFW hall with shag carpeting from the 1970s. I mean, it fits. It certainly fits.
Totally fits.
Now, you had mentioned in the very beginning of the conversation here that thank God, you're doing well, you're healthy, you're fine. But as an independent artist, you're doing well, you make some money, you get a song licensed somewhere, you do these house concerts, you have an album out, and then you go and in concert, you know, people buy the album. But what do you do in terms of, like, health insurance and making sure if I'm sick, God forbid, 5 years from now, are you safe?
I'm probably in a little better place than most, but my insurance can, you know, when you're with a SAG or an ASCAP, which is great, but you have to keep up a certain level of income, and it's always a little bit dicey. And that's the thing, is musicians really have always had a really sad SAG union, and there's no health care, and I know so many people that are, have gone into bankruptcy, musicians. Mm-hmm. And it's as the music industry is, you know, nobody's buying music and everyone's streaming, and then artists like myself can't regularly hire musicians to go tour with. So I think it's there used to be a working class musician and a middle-class musician who can't find, I don't know where people how people can do it as much anymore. It's got to figure out new ways, and that's part of the crowdsourcing is one of them. And
I mean, the revenue streams, you know, for a normal day-to-day life, you tour, you do this, and there's a revenue scheme where you can live fairly comfortably. But it's just that oh my God, that catastrophic thing. And if health insurance for someone who doesn't work for a big company is probably, you know, $1,000 a month now. It's nuts. So that's why I wonder and worry about for people like you, people in your position. I mean, do you still get royalties from, like, I Kissed a Girl, or only the record label does?
Oh, my God. But yeah, because I never really recouped because they put in so much money at the time.
Ugh.
And people having semi-hits right now. I mean, it's shocking what people are making nowadays that are actually having semi-hits right now.
Now, I am kind of also wondering, and this is more of an aesthetic question, but in terms of, since you're not with a label, you're the own label, deciding, like, when you write a song, it's like, I'm going to keep this acoustic, it sounds nice, it'll be cheap, versus, I want this produced, maybe a little strings, maybe, because I want to get across the idea that Nostalgia Kills has a lot of instrumentation on it, it's lovely, it isn't just a little folk strummy album. How do you make that? Is it ever financial, or is it always, I hear this song with electric guitars, drum, bass, and
maybe
one violin?
Yeah, I haven't been the brightest, probably, in my, I spend money when I record, because it's like, if I want a string quartet, I'm going to get, not just a string quartet, I'm going to get a really good string quartet. A part of me was like, I did really well at Kickstarter. I was like, damn, I should have just sent it on my iPhone for $20, you know? But, you know, I still have that old world sensibility where if I hear something I wanted, I'm going to do it.
And another question is that it has taken a very long time for this album to come out, but it's not as if you hadn't been writing bunches of songs, not even the ones that for the theater, but you put things on your website all the time, as you said, your iPhone and probably YouTube stuff. Is there ever going to be here's an idea for you, like a compilation box set of the Sobule rarities?
That's a really good idea. Well, I put together Jill Comes Alive, which is like a curated live show. I mean, of 18 songs of live songs, and I really love that. And people can get it at my store, JillSobule.com. But I really like the idea of this. Of, you know, hopefully, I feel like I'm getting, you know, my name a little more out there, and people are discovering or rediscovering me. So I think that's a really good idea, Rabbi.
Oh, well, there you go. See, it was Bashert that we spoke today. Also, Bashert, that you're reminding everybody of your website, JillSobule.com. It's Jill spelled the usual way. Well, usually it's in Hebrew, but that, now it's in English. Jill Sobule, SOBULE.com. And, of course, please go see her on November 17th at E-Town Hall in Boulder, Colorado. Beautiful Boulder. Now, is that a solo acoustic, or do you have a band, or what will people see there?
No, they're going to see me acoustic. But, like, you know, I want them to know it's not just like a girl with a guitar or boy with a guitar. I tell stories. I wing it. I never know what I'm going to play.
Wow.
Wing it. I'll tell stories. I'll gossip.
It sounds like a tremendous amount of fun. And I only wish we could. Everybody listening, go see her if you're in Colorado. And, of course, you're in the midst of a tour. You'll be in other cities, too, during this...
I'm going to be...
I don't have that in front of me. I just have the Colorado.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be in St. Louis. Go to my website, JillSobule.com, and people can see where I'm going to be.
And, of course, people can buy your new CD, Nostalgia Kills, at JillSobule.com as well. As always, it has been a joy and a delight.
Oh,
I would say, if you're going to pick a second single from the album, I love I Put My Headphones On. That's just...
I was going to just say it.
Oh, go ahead, say it then. What?
I put my headphones on.
Yeah, it's just so catchy and such a wonderful tribute. And again, it's that idea of being taken out of the current life and either dreaming or just going where the song is taking you. Do remember the moment of that song's creation? Because it's already one of my favorite songs of yours now of all time.
Oh. Well, that song originally was written and it was never used for this musical Times Square, and it was about the young girl who's listening to her favorite radio show in New York City in the 70s, and music is this young girl, the character in the play, music is what's saving her. It's really her only solace. And the character was kind of me. So we didn't use the song, and I changed it and made it more me, and so that's where it came from.
Actually, that does lead... I know I just said that was the last question, but now it's the penultimate question leading to the last question, which is, when people listen to, especially this current album, I mean, how much do you fudge a little, or how much is really autobiographical when you give a lot of details in a lot of the songs? Is it like...
I think this one's really autobiographical.
Ooh.
Sure.
Oh, that, I hope it comes with a lyric sheet then, because, well, of course, it should come with a lyric sheet, because Jill Sobule is a marvelous lyricist as well as a greatly lyrical composer. You've got to get her old albums, and especially her new one, Nostalgia Kills. It is killing me to let you go, but I know you have busy things to do and to prepare and tour, so Jill Sobule, it just remains for me to say what a blessing it has been to have you back in the neighborhood.
Been a joy to talk to you, and it won't be this long, I promise.
Halavai. Let's not make it 10 years. Look, I mean, it won't be 2 weeks. We gotta leave a little time, but several weeks, and then we'll do this again.
I'm ready.
Shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi.